Hvor kan man lade kan ikke lade
ikke.
Michael O'Carter, which is my own touch while I'm fighting her over us, because in Strihu panel. That's all a sokum, because you a hedge, I guess, now which you brought her shot, no, a couple of sessions, Tawata, a local of Ogin Tronona. This session is going to be in English. Yeah, that's my fault. My Welsh and my Scots Gaelic aren't at the level they should be. We're spending the whole day speaking about rights. Yeah, and responsibilities, and we probably should have had translation available, but this is how it is. So the idea behind this session was, in the media here, when we're talking about Act na Gaeilge, it's always mentioned that there's language legislation in the south of Ireland, in Wales, and in Scotland. But what does that really mean? You know, and how does it compare to the situation here? Like Colm, you were speaking about the experiences in the south. The dynamics aren't exactly the same to do with the government. When we think Wales and Scotland, there is some similar dynamics. So I thought it'd be interesting to get the three perspectives, and that would lead up to the discussion that we're going to have in the afternoon. So I'm delighted to welcome our two speakers. First, we're going to have Mary Hughes, who's going to speak. Mary's the language commissioner for Wales, and she's going to speak about the Welsh situation, and then Dr. Douglas Chalmers is going to speak about Scots Gaelic. So I'll let Mary take the floor.
Diolch yn fawr. And can I apologise as well? I wish my Irish was better, and had I listened to Hynydd Andrews, who works in our office in North Wales and is a product of Belfast, my Irish would be better. So dwi'n ymddiheirio o wylod calon, dwi'n mynd I ddefnyddio'n ail iaith, I'm going to use my second language to give this presentation. Can I also thank you for this opportunity? What's been really stunning over the past months, or the past 9 months I'd say, is I can be certain that once a week I will have a phone call from either the Irish Times, BBC Northern Ireland, or somewhere asking about what's happening in Northern Ireland? Is it similar to what's happened in Wales? And can you tell me something about what should happen? Now, I'm not certain I can do the should, but I can certainly talk about what's happened in Wales. And that's what I want to do this afternoon. Briefly, about our experiences of language legislation, some of the pitfalls, some of the positive features. And can I say that I'm standing here today saying that the journey over the past decade has been positive. It's been painful, but it's been positive. It's about growth, it's about movement. And can I just urge those of you that are on that journey in Ireland as well, it's the bad, the good, and the indifferent, but it all leads to positive change. I'm Mary Hughes, I'm the Welsh Language Commissioner. I've been the Welsh Language Commissioner now for 6 years. I'm the first Welsh Language Commissioner in Wales. I'm a statutory commissioner. I'll talk a bit about that role in a minute. I'm just coming up to the end of my tenure, my mandate. My mandate is a 7-year mandate. I cannot reapply. I'm not certain that my energy levels would allow me to reapply, but I cannot reapply. It's a 7-year role. And I will talk a little about the legislation which established my role. And where we're going as well, because I think that's really, really important. Graeme Fraser, who's just retired as the Canadian Language Commissioner, as he visited Wales last year and as he left, he said the one thing you're going to have to remember is there is no destination. A language is a living entity. There is no, we've achieved it, we've got there. It will always be a battle with minority languages, but it's a battle that's worth fighting. Right, Welsh language legislation. I'm going to take you on a very, very quick whistle-stop tour of language legislation in Wales, and it is very quick and very superficial in many ways. Act of Union 1536 united England and Wales. They called it uniting, we called it a takeover bid. I don't think I'm supposed to say things like that, but I think after 1536, I'll get away with that one. Okay, Act of Union 1536, England and Wales became one political, civic entity. And it was stated very, very clearly in the Act of Union that the Welsh language was not to be used in any aspect of public life in Wales. It was perceived to be disruptive, it was perceived to be a negative feature of the Welsh nation, and the sooner they got rid of the language, the better for everybody. So it was stated that anyone in public office using the Welsh language would immediately lose their post, would not be kept on in that post, and it was deemed to be absolutely unacceptable to use the language. Those of you that know Wales, we've got the seaboard and then we have that border with England. The only person who couldn't actually fulfil the requirement of working through the medium of English, and the only person that actually lost his job, was the coroner in Radnorshire. Now, if you visited Radnorshire today, you could be, I'd understand if you thought you were in the middle of England. It's such an anglicised county, but at that time, that person who's sitting right on the border with England couldn't use the Welsh language. So Acts of Union 1536, why did the language survive? Very, very briefly, because the Bible was translated into Welsh. Bishop William Morgan translated the Bible. So the Welsh language became the language of religion, faith and home and community. And that kept the language alive despite industrialisation, despite really strong attempts by Westminster government to get rid of the language. There were a series of reports during the period between 1536 and the early 20th century. There was a very famous report on the condition of the Welsh miners, those that went underground to mine coal. And their poverty was commented upon, and it was also commented upon if they stopped using this native language, they may actually get a bit richer. There was the treason of the Blue Books, which stated that the Welsh language was detrimental to education, a series of reports back in the 19th century. So there were a series of reports throughout that period seeking to place the Welsh language as a problem for the Welsh nation. However, despite that, early 20th century, early growth of Welsh nationalism, we had the incident of the bombing school in North Wales being burnt by three eminent Welsh nationalists, Saunders Lewis, Lewis Valentine and DJ Williams. They faced court in Old Bailey and were imprisoned for that. And that literally lit the match, which commenced a discussion about linguistic rights in Wales and nationalism, political nationalism. That grew during the mid-20th century, and in 1942, in the Welsh Courts Act, which was then followed by the 1967 Welsh Language Act, the Welsh language was, interestingly, growing in strength in the judicial system. Now, it's ironic. It was actually within the court system that the language started to establish a foothold in Wales in public service terms. Largely, again, because of the influence of a number of eminent Welsh-speaking judges who actually saw the language as being important. It is important for witnesses, for those that wanted to talk about their experiences, to be able to do that through the Welsh language in the court system. Earlier this year, we celebrated the passing of the Welsh Language Act 1967, which was 50 years ago, a clear statement that those who wished to use the Welsh language in the Welsh court system could do so. And it was the beginning of simultaneous translation, the beginning of the hearing of Welsh in traditional spheres which had not been Welsh speaking. We hadn't heard the language in the courts. We hadn't heard the language in public life. So an interesting journey from 1536 to 1967, a surprising journey. Centuries and centuries of very active oppression of the language, but in the 20th century, we started to see the move towards recognition of the language as a living entity and an entity to ensure that it did live, and recognition through legislation, early legislation, of rights. I will talk about the Welsh Language Act 1993, I'll talk about the Welsh Language Wales Measure 2011 a little later on. Welsh Language Act 1993. Interesting piece of legislation, passed by Westminster Government, passed by a Conservative Westminster Government. Welsh Language Act 1993 was the first of the two big pieces of legislation that have led to my role. So Welsh Language Act 1993, as I say, passed by Welsh Government, it would have an impact on the situation that there were Welsh Nationalist MPs sitting in Westminster since 1966, since Gwynfor Evans won the first seat in Westminster elections. We had a Nationalist presence, albeit small, 3-4 members in Westminster Government. However, as has happened very, very many times with the language, it was interesting that a Conservative government saw this as a way of possibly placating what they saw as a growth of nationalism in Wales. Am I reading conspiracy into their actions? Possibly. But it was interesting that it is a Conservative government. We'd had in early 1980s the establishment of S4C, our Welsh Language Television Channel, through Westminster Government, and we saw a piece of legislation. This piece of legislation essentially gave the Welsh and English languages equal recognition in public life in Wales. It did not give the Welsh language official status. The wording of the 1993 legislation is interesting, that the languages should be treated equally. What that meant was up for discussion, but that Welsh and English language should be treated on an equal basis in public life in Wales. It placed a duty on the public sector to treat the Welsh and English languages on an equal basis when providing services to the public in Wales. And it really ended that final journey of giving Welsh language speakers the right to speak the language in court. At the same time, it established a regime of Welsh language schemes. You've heard about Irish language schemes today. 1993 was the beginning of Welsh language schemes in Wales. Welsh language schemes were requirements placed on public sector organisations in Wales. If you were a public sector organisation, you had to have a language scheme. You developed your own language scheme. You stated clearly what services you would deliver to the public and how you would deliver them. That scheme then was ratified by an organisation called the Welsh Language Board, which was a quangle. It was a semi-autonomous government organisation. They signed off the scheme and they monitored the scheme. As a consequence of the 1993 legislation, I think we can say two things very clearly. It commenced a journey of establishing language rights for individuals receiving public services in Wales. It commenced that journey of placing that duty on public service bodies. What it also did was lead to general confusion as to what those rights were. By 2010, there were 650 language schemes in Wales, statutory language schemes. They were all different. They were all tailored to specific organisations. So as a service user, you walked into a public sector organisation and you were reliant on their specific language scheme for any services. So you could walk into a local authority in Cardiff and have a very different experience to the one in Carmarthen or in Caernarfon. There was no consistency, there was no certainty or clarity as to rights. That, as I say, commenced a journey, but the journey had become complex, chaotic, and really did not give individuals that certainty of this is my right. Before I talk about the 2011 legislation, which is what has created my role, can I just talk about, for briefly, what devolution has done in Wales? Devolution has been an interesting journey when you look at language rights, and has been a very significant step in that language rights journey in Wales. For the first ever instance ever, the Welsh language became a statutory duty on a specific government body. The National Assembly of Wales had a legal duty to, or responsibility, to legislate for the language. Now, that had never ever existed in Westminster, because 1536 stated quite clearly that the Welsh language should not be in existence by the 20th century. So it was the first time ever that statutory responsibility for the Welsh language was placed upon a governmental body, in the National Assembly for Wales. And that was really, really significant, because for the first time ever, it was possible to ask a government body, what are you going to do about this language? It is in your jurisdiction. You have no choice to ignore it. And to be fair, there was no real will to ignore it within the National Assembly. As you see there, the Government of Wales Act 2006 set out what the duties were. However, there was a political will to consider the language. And from the very, very early days of the National Assembly as a governmental body in Wales, devolved governmental body in Wales, primary legislation has been a bilingual tool. We draft legislation bilingually. We operate bilingually. And I think that's critical in the way that the National Assembly has really taken on board and normalised the language within the political sphere in Wales. What it has also done through creation of legislation, general legislation and legislation relating to the language, is create a discourse, is to create a debate around citizenship, rights and status. The Westminster legislation essentially was about public service duty. We shifted. It was more about the experience of being a citizen, a person in Wales, and that person's rights to have access to services, to experiences in their own language. And as I've mentioned before, working within a bilingual environment, if you visit the National Assembly, from its very, very early days, everything is translated. All its proceedings are translated. The daily, it's not called a Hansard, but the daily record is available in both languages. So there's a real statement within the Assembly, which has been important in terms of creating that legislative landscape. Devolution, I would argue, has been critical for us in Wales in ensuring that our legislation has moved towards, and is moving towards, it hasn't achieved it yet, rights-based legislation. One of the first pieces of legislation passed by the Assembly was the Welsh Language Wales Measure 2011. Linguistic legislative competency was in 2011, and in that period prior to 2011, it was not full legislative competency. So the National Assembly didn't have full lawmaking powers. That's a more recent development. But in the period leading up to the passing of the Welsh Language Wales Measure 2011, we were working in a hybrid environment. It was a period of the Legislative Competency Order, where we required Westminster permission before we could actually move ahead with legislation. However, in relation to the Welsh Language Wales Measure 2011, that competency was given to the National Assembly, they were allowed to develop a new piece of legislation which would essentially repeal the 1993 legislation and move us ahead. So the Westminster legislation of 1993, which had led to that growth of language schemes, was usurped by a piece of legislation which also, in a very, very limited fashion, reflected the move from duty to rights. So what did the Welsh Language Wales measure do? In the first instance, and I cannot overstate, I cannot state how important this has been, it gave the Welsh language official status in Wales. Now, many civil servants had argued over this decade since 1993, well, you've got that anyway, by default. But Section 1 of the Welsh Language Measure states the Welsh language has official status in Wales. And during the past 6-7 years, that has been critical for me in my role. If I go into Tesco's and say, where are your Welsh language signs? The first question is usually, well, we don't know, we haven't thought about that. And then they say, Welsh language official status? Is it an official language in Wales? You say, yes. And they say, oh, okay then, fine. Yes, we will provide your bilingual signs. So that, had it done nothing else, having that official status would have been critical. The measure also established my role as Welsh Language Commissioner. Welsh Language Commissioner role is part of a family of language commissioners, and I think we need to recognise that. You heard this morning from our colleagues in Ireland. There are 5 language commissioners in Canada. There's a language commissioner in Kosovo, and there are 2 ombudsmen, the Catalan and the Basque ombudsman, who operate essentially as language commissioners in their country. So the role of language commissioner is part of that movement towards the need to recognise the language as a living language within a jurisdiction. My role is an interesting role. It's a hybrid role. There are, I would argue, 3 statutory responsibilities which are placed upon me through our legislation. In the first instance, I am a regulator. And in a minute, I'll talk about the standards which are now placed upon public sector organisations in Wales. So I'm a regulator. I'm also an advocate stroke ombudsman. I accept complaints. I will investigate complaints on behalf of individuals. And thirdly, and it is so critical, I am a promoter of the language. Now, many people argue you can't be a regulator and a promoter at the same time. I would disagree. You can regulate, but regulation should be the end of the game, not the beginning of the game. If you're regulating on a regular basis, you're not succeeding. So the promotional side for me is critical. Explaining why organisations, businesses, third sector organisations should be using the language. Taking them on that journey of education. Explaining what the rights of individuals in Wales are. And then, if need be, regulating and dealing with complaints. So I think it's critical when you're looking at a language commissioner role that you see that as hybrid, that you see it as a combination of all those functions working together. And that's certainly the powers which I have and which I'm pleased I have. Can I say that not everybody thinks it's a very good idea that I have that much power? There are certain individuals, some of them appear on Newsnight every so often, who actually believe that I've got far too many powers, or that this role has far too many powers. But I think in terms of effective language legislation, you need that point of final resolution. You need that person you turn to when you need encouragement or when things have gone wrong. The other thing which the Welsh Language Wales measure does is create a body of duties which are placed upon public sector organisations. We are moving from Welsh language schemes, the 650 unique schemes that gave no consistency of rights, to standards. I'm not going to lose. There we are. Very briefly, just to reiterate, those were the policy objectives behind the Welsh Language Wales measure. And I think it's important that in looking at any language legislation, that you look at the words on the paper, you look at what's actually stated in the legislation, but also understand what the policy objectives were and are. So to give the Welsh language official status, tick. To ensure that the Welsh language is treated no less favourably than the English language, fine. The third component is the real shift from the 1993 duties-based legislation to the 2011 legislation. What the Welsh Language Wales measure states very clearly is that people in Wales should be free and also encouraged to live their lives through the medium of Welsh, and it states that in the legislation. Now that is a very clear policy statement which we can use very, very effectively, not only with organisations under duties, but with organisations that may not be under those statutory duties, but are operating within Wales. And we've just had an organisation, and I'll name them, Sports Direct, who placed a notice on a board in a shop in Bangor, advising their workers that English was the language of operation of that company. We could very, very quickly get in there and say, have you seen the legislation? Have you seen what it actually says? And we received an apology, and there was a generalised apology. So having those various components is critical. Can I talk a little about Welsh language standards? Welsh language schemes, as I say, changed the political landscape, but had led to complexity and uncertainty. Welsh language standards are set out in the legislation in five different families of legislative statutory duties. There are standards in relation to service delivery. So public sector organisations, they're dealing with the public, whether it be face-to-face communications, whether it be through correspondence, whether it be on the phone, whether it be online, there are duties in terms of service delivery. There are duties, standards in relation to policy making. There are duties placed on organisations, specific standards stating that when they make any policy decision, there has to be a linguistic impact assessment of that policy decision. Even if it's a decision not to collect the rubbish every week, there has to be. And some would say that's disproportionate, but it becomes normalised practice that they have to go through a linguistic impact assessment. There are standards in relation to operational issues. Those are new. Those are about how organisations operate internally. How do they deal with their staff? So those standards require public sector organisations, and those organisations under standards, to make sure that their staff have contracts, of course, bilingually, that they can attend disciplinary meetings, meetings with their senior staff members in the language of their choice. If the line manager cannot deal with that, there is a requirement that simultaneous translation is brought in. There are standards now. I can see some faces in the audience going, ooh. Yes, that was the response from public sector and other organisations in Wales. However, they have surprised themselves that it actually isn't that onerous. It is not that difficult. That actually with some creative thinking, these things are possible. So those standards have been critical and are critical. And I can just say this is a journey. Those standards are really critical in changing the experience of the worker within an organisation. There are promotional standards, essentially standards which require organisations, they can provide the service, but they actually have to offer the service in an active way as well. It's not just good enough to say, well, yes, of course, we've got the service, but nobody uses it. Have you actually marketed it? Have you made people aware that it's a bilingual service? So there are promotional standards, and then there are record-keeping standards. They actually have to keep the evidence for us to scrutinise that they are complying with standards. As I come to the end of this whistle-stop tour, what are our reflections in terms of what works and what doesn't work in relation to Welsh language legislation? Can I stress in the first instance, this is a journey. So there are positives, there are negatives, and it isn't anything that the other issue is that journey, as I said at the beginning, it has its moments of sheer pain and it has its moments of sheer pleasure. You see lights going on in organisational windows and in chief executives' minds, and they suddenly realise, I'm running a bilingual organisation. However, there are real, real challenges in terms of culture which remain. So what I'm going to describe is not sheer success, far from it. But the strengths. Language legislation, giving a language official status, absolutely critical. I cannot stress, I described the Tesco moment, but...
Maybe Little House?
Yes, absolutely. Being able to say very, very clearly, we work very closely with the banks, the high street banks, who've had their moments as well in the past years, but we've worked with them over the last 2 years in Wales and using official status. And it's amazing how banks, such as the one which is represented downstairs here, they get it because they say, well, you know, yes, we have to deliver several languages in Spain. We don't see the problem of delivering Welsh and English in Wales. That's not a problem. The movement, and it is a movement, towards establishing language rights within legislation. That's a difficult journey, because how do you do it? With the Welsh Language Wales measure, the 2011 legislation, the word rights only appears once in 136 pages of legislation. That's only in English. It's bilingual, so it's 278 pages. The word rights only appears in the long title of the legislation. However, as the language legislation has been implemented, as the duties and the standards have been placed on organisations, we have been stressing this creates rights. This isn't about some bureaucratic exercise, some organisational exercise, just to make sure that you've got every form bilingually. This is very, very clearly about empowering and giving people rights, and the right to live your life through the Welsh language in Wales, if that is your choice. So it has, without realising it, led to a far more sophisticated discussion about language rights. The legislation places a clear duty on organisations to comply rather than individuals to ask for services. Now that tipping point is important. I've lived through decades of walking into offices and thinking, oh, I suppose I'm going to have to ask, do you have a Welsh language form? Do you have someone who can speak to me in Welsh? But gently, gently, we're seeing that tipping over into organisations actively offering the service and knowing that they have a duty to do that. The other thing which the standards have done, moving away from the language schemes, is create consistency across sectors. So the standards that have been passed, and their statutory standards have been passed in regulations which correspond to specific sectors. So the first package of standards which were passed, the first set of regulations that were passed, were for all local authorities, national parks, and Welsh Government in Wales. So 26 organisations in all were in that first set of regulations. So local authorities, Welsh Government, and the national parks have been working with their regulations, their standards now for 18 months. The second set were standards that were set or placed upon the large national organisations in Wales. So our National Library, National Museum, Energy Wales, Cyfoeth Naturiol Cymru, our energy body, BBC in Wales, they came into that second package of standards. So they were set, and they've been working within the standards regime now for just under 12 months. The third set of standards were placed upon the police forces in Wales. So each police force and all our fire and emergency bodies are now working under a common set of standards. And we have just placed our compliance notices on all our further education colleges and universities in Wales. So from 1 week ago, they are working within standards in Wales. So they are working, and that's where the consistency becomes, not only consistency for the service user, but all those organisations are working to the same rules. As a consequence, they're talking to each other. They're sharing services. They're not reinventing wheels. They're working together. The other component, which is really, really important, is that issue of active offer. In Wales, you will walk into most organisations now and you'll see people wearing the little orange speech bubble. That indicates that they are Welsh speakers. You'll see that everywhere, from TK Maxx to Welsh Government. And I have seen it in TK Maxx fairly regularly. It's being used as part of the active offer. Weaknesses, and I'll draw this to an end in a minute. Weaknesses, legislation's complex. The drafts people, they drafted it bilingually, and they drafted it in a very, very dark room. I wish they'd put the light on. I wish they'd got out a little more. But it's a very, very complex piece of legislation. It's long. It's 276 pages in both languages. We are waiting for that moment when someone challenges the English versus the Welsh version of a word. It's going to happen. But it is very complex. And if there's a message for any drafts people in the audience, make it simple. Essentially, all you need in language legislation is a statement of rights and official status. Okay, don't forget the official status. The legislation, our legislation, is obsessed with process. Totally, totally obsessed with process rather than outcomes. It's process so heavy. I end up checking it on a daily basis just to see when I'm supposed to take my lunch almost. It's that detailed as to what the Commissioner can do and can't do. This is where I'm going to end. The ultimate question of any legislative regime is, does it make a difference? We've had the language legislation, our present legislation, since 2011. As I said, local authorities have been operating standards for the last 18 months. Part of our role as Commissioner, part of my role as Commissioner, is to actually look at the impact of standards. And we do that through monitoring activity. We undertake a lot of secret shopper surveys. We also commission external pieces of research, not quite hidden camera, but almost hidden camera. We undertake focus groups. We do a lot of discussion with the public. And our latest report is going to be published on Wednesday. Once a year, we publish a report which pulls together all that research activity and focuses on the experiences of the service user. What we do is say, right, as a Welsh person in Wales, what does it actually feel like to access public services, access different services? I've left little leaflets around the place. This will be our third assurance report. So this will be the first one since the standards have been fully operational in local authorities, Welsh Government and the National Parks. And the findings, I have to say, are, well, amazing, possibly is a strong word, but significant. A year ago, we tested phone calls, if you phone a public service body, were they answering the phone bilingually? And were they offering you a service in Welsh? A year ago, it was something just over 50% of bodies in Wales were getting it right. The work we did last year, it's gone up to 91% of public service bodies that we tested in terms of a totally secret shopper. It was over 91% of bodies were succeeding. Really significant changes in reception areas. These are appearing everywhere. 54% of reception areas were complying fully. Now, that was 28% the year before. Now, 54%, you'd argue, well, come on, you know, it's 46% that haven't actually achieved it. But that level of growth of service, and that's across Wales, it's not in your traditional Welsh language areas alone. Service users, people are actually telling us very, very actively, this is making a difference. We can actually feel the change. And I can feel the change. I can walk into an office and actually I can see, I can hear the language everywhere. It's not just an occasional sign. It's there. I don't think I'm fooling myself. And the other thing which is really, really positive is that those chief executives of those organisations that have been working within out the standards for the longest period, and it's only 18 months, their response is, it wasn't as painful as we thought it was going to be. Actually, it was quite easy once we planned it properly. And we're getting really positive feedback from people. People like it. They're complimenting us, which makes chief executives feel good about themselves. So there is a positive journey in terms of the change. Where are the challenges? I've mentioned cultural change. That's still a big, big issue. Yes, we're seeing change. It's not 100%. There are still pockets, not helped by the press at times. There are, you know, negative arguments which emerge every so often about how much is this costing? And what's the payback? You can answer that question in a minute. Mm-hmm. That negativity is still there. A big challenge is persuading people to plan for bilingual services from the beginning and not see it as delivering the English language service and then thinking, oh, now we've got to think about the Welsh language one. It's about that mindset, the switch into bilingual operation throughout. And IT systems can be both a saviour and a problem. And that's one of the big challenges for us, is actually working with IT systems. They can actually be the answer to many of these challenges as well. I'm going to jump those because I really think the message, certainly from me, is we have been and are on a journey. Language legislation is challenging. It's challenging for politicians. It's challenging culturally. And that's true in our country as well. We're going through a whole discussion at the moment, again, about do we need to review our legislation, etc., etc. However, language legislation doesn't answer all of the questions. Language legislation is the beginning of a journey, not the end of the journey. And certainly that is the experience for us. If we didn't have our promotional functions, if we didn't undertake the work we do with third sector organisations, with the business sector as well, language legislation would be quite sterile. So for me, language legislation is part of a package of language planning. But heck, it's a critical part of it. Language legislation, which places both status and rights and ascribes those to a minority language, are very, very, very powerful tools. And I would encourage you to continue the debate here. Diolch yn fawr.
Thank you, Maria. That was really interesting. That was actually really uplifting when you see what actually can be achieved.
Yeah.
Yep. We have time for a few questions if anyone would like to ask Mary about any part of her talk. Could I ask, is there any research been done about use and awareness?
Yeah.
You know, it always comes into the debate, but is there someone that is actually looking at
this?
Yes.
We undertook 2 years ago, we published with Welsh Government, we commissioned a large scale, and it's been signed off by Office of National Statistics, so it's a solid piece of work on language usage, because it was one of these, it was the elephant that was sitting in the room, and kept on sitting in the room, and we decided, well, rather than let someone else talk to the elephant, we'd go and talk to the elephant. And we undertook that piece of work, it's on our website. And it raises all those issues about impact of education, impact of decades of activity which has been English focused, official language of Wales, English, throughout my life until fairly recently. So it looks at those issues and starts the discussion about how do we now change those features. Active offer is critical, and that's, you know, if you walk into an office and it becomes agor ask again, it is a significant barrier. If people feel that they're being a nuisance, particularly in the health settings, you know, I'm going to have, someone's really, really going to make my life difficult, and I don't want to upset this little nurse who's being so lovely to me. So we've done a lot of work on that. So we have some of the answers when organisations say usage is low. We can raise those issues, and then we ask, well, have you got an active offer? Do you market? No, we don't, we hadn't thought of that. Well, what's the point of delivering a service if you don't actually make it evident? So we've done a piece of work, so we'd be happy to share that, because that's been
and
so
now
useful.
That the standards are in place, you would think that in a few years' time, if the research was carried out, that you would see a difference in uptake, because people don't feel like it's a chore to ask for these services. Yeah, any other?
Well, does the Commission have any leverage or experience or will when it comes to food and product labelling? So can you say something about that?
Yes. One of the pieces of work we undertook outside the statutory placing of standards on organisations was seeking to identify places where we could start using the language quite positively, and there were two areas where we identified we could start using the language in a positive way. Sports, and we've worked very, very closely with the Sports Council in Wales to introduce Welsh into identity, into training, into coaching, into part of that, what makes a Welsh sportsman. Well, actually it's quite handy that they speak the language. So we've been giving sports people Welsh language training on the basis of, you know, the BBC will talk to you twice rather than once. Once in English, once in Welsh, when you win your medal. So we've worked closely with the Sports Council in that sphere. But the other sphere that we identified very, very quickly was agriculture. And then we honed that down to food and drink. And again, we've published a piece of work 2 years ago on the economic impact of Welsh language branding on food and drink products in Wales. Now, we didn't have sufficiently sophisticated ways of measuring to take that much further forward, but Welsh Government picked that piece of research up and they've just replicated that, and they can now place figures, actual economic figures, on the value of Welsh language branding. And I can give you the contacts where, and they've taken that now. They were looking at Welsh language branding within Wales. You know, you will buy the butter, which has got a dragon in it, because you think, and it says Menin, because you know it's been produced down the road. But they're now replicating that in Sheffield, Birmingham and Manchester, because they reckon there's international value to the Welsh language in branding of food and drink, which is great. So yes, there are significant pieces of work that have been done in that sphere.
Yeah.
You've answered some of the questions that I already asked. The previous question that I was going to ask was the idea of the, you know, convincing the business world that there's a value, and there's a business value within language. I mean, Fintan, I think, mentioned this earlier on. You know, one of the arguments is the heritage language idea. Okay, it's a good pastime, etc. But how do you actually convince people? One of the biggest challenges with the Irish language has always been, you know, in particular in the Gaeltacht areas, to convince people to use, you know, the language in every sphere of life, no matter what level it is, whether it's in the banking world or the medical world. Have you found much resistance in terms of, you mentioned Sports Direct earlier on as an example of bad practice. Have you found that there has been much resistance from the bigger companies in the promotion of Welsh, or have they generally been buying in? And I know that you've answered a bit of the question with the Welsh branding, but has there been any active resistance by corporate companies?
Do you know, I wouldn't, it isn't active resistance, it's inactive ignorance.
Okay.
Lidl, and I will name them because it was public, some years ago, did something similar, put a notice out to all their staff saying English is the language of operation in the UK. And we immediately had to respond. So I managed to get hold of the chief exec of Lidl. And he was extremely apologetic and said, I'm a German, I should have realised that there were other languages. I made a big, big, big mistake. So when, I've been surprised that you can actually, if you say it's an official language, it's a governmental language, it is actually a part of our day-to-day life, not just in the home and in the community, but in public life. They slowly change. So I've been surprised.
Yeah, Art, were you looking at?
Yeah, Jochen Bauer, do you not think that in Wales, that officialdom is much more favourably disposed to Welsh, whereas in the north you've got a really underlying sectarian element to the language question here? So it seems that in Wales, the door's quite open. I mean, the Westminster government is quite favourable for Welsh language rights, and I'm sure the Westminster government themselves are probably quite favourable for Irish language rights. But it's the kind of storm administration, really, that sees any permitting of expression of Irishness or Gaelicness as somehow undermining or undercutting British unionism, Protestant identity. I mean, I think that's probably, I mean, there's a different set of circumstances I think we're probably dealing with in the six counties here as opposed to the Wales.
I'm not an expert at all. On the reality of life here, and I would say that I can't draw those comparisons. It's we experience resistance, and it can get pretty nasty, but I don't think it's as deep and as, you know, set within specific communities as it is here. But I would not attempt to comment on something. The resistance, you know, we experience is, as I say, can be difficult, and can be quite personal. However, I do think we've got a fairer wind from politicians than probably 1536 was not a good period for the Welsh language, but I think 2017 is slightly better in governmental terms.
Okay, I said a lot of this can be picked up again in the later sessions, but the two questions, two people meeting Padraig, and then call him, and then we'll move on to Padraig or case.
Yeah. Sort of compromises that's been thrown about, I suppose, since about March is this idea from someone as yourself who deals with single language legislation, is the idea that Ulster Scots will be put in the mix in a joint languages or combined cultures act in terms of joint legislation. We are aware that in terms of international best practice in terms of language development and legislative protection, that the international advice is that you don't put two languages in the single piece of legislation because there are different stages of development and demand that it can actually be detrimental to both languages. In terms of trying to disseminate that argument or that debate, would you have any advice how we could progress that sort of impasse around the debate here?
Interestingly, when the 1993 legislation was passed in Westminster, there was discussion about making it an official languages act and placing the English language and the Welsh language within that legislation for Wales. And at that time, it was argued that there was such an imbalance between those two languages anyway. And as you say, they had very different histories, that it would create a battle within the piece of legislation. And although that's the model for the official languages legislation, 1969 legislation in Canada. However, as years have moved on, particularly around minority languages, I think the recognition is try and create a piece of legislation specifically for that language, tailored to that language. Otherwise you create an internal battle within the legislation.
I suppose one of the major challenges we face is around capacity, just having sufficient people in the right places to actually deliver services. So just interest in terms of Wales, in terms of, like, have you know, specific strategies around recruitment, capacity, or is it a case that they just naturally come through the education system and you have sufficient capacity coming through for who have the ability to actually deliver services in both languages?
We've had 30 or 40 years, 30 years of official Welsh medium education in Wales. Again, good, bad and indifferent. Some of that has been excellent and some of that has not been good. We have a capacity challenge, but the capacity challenge, I would argue, is within our education sphere, where we need to be ensuring that the young people that we are educating are truly bilingual when they come out of the system. If we succeeded in doing that and we're getting much, much, much better at it, there won't be a capacity issue. There shouldn't be a capacity issue. There should be sufficient people to fill these roles in Wales. Particularly when you're talking about public-facing services, we're getting there. We have greater challenges when you come to nurses and doctors, but we are actually addressing those now through our through further education and higher education. It's getting better. So capacity isn't as much of an issue as it is in other places.
And do standards have to take account of that, or where you're dealing with sectors?
Standards, to some extent, take account of that, in that if you take a sector such as councils, local authorities, they're exactly the same standards for all. The one thing we would possibly be, and we have been, more lenient on are timescales. So a local authority in South East Wales, very, very traditional, industrialised area, not much tradition of Welsh language service delivery. We've said, okay, rather than 6 months to achieve the standard, we'll give you 12. Or 18. So that's where we've been reasonable and proportionate. However, it's amazing, I have to say, now that we are creating a need, we're actually finding the supply is coming out of the woodwork as well. People are finding that they do have Welsh language skills that they always had them, but they weren't possibly advertising them. But now that when they know there are posts and jobs, they're saying, oh yes. I've got my GCSE Welsh.
Great, so. Bill Bottle. So, let's go welcome our second speaker. That's Douglas, Dr. Douglas Chalmers, who's going to speak about the Scottish.
Would you like to take it out for me? Okay, thank you very much. Hello, Karchin. Hami Dulich, Ach Hanielach, Gaelic Albanach, Akum, Agus Femi Abrien, Verla. I'm sorry, I don't have any. I've only got the sort of smaller version of Irish, which of course is Scottish Gaelic, so haven't grown up yet properly perhaps, so I'm afraid I'll be speaking in English. But I hope it is useful. I'm glad that some of you are interested in the economic aspect, because I am an economist. My area of research is the economics of minority language. And when I usually speak, if I usually get invited to conferences on languages, it's either economists know the price of everything and the value of nothing, or possibly even the economists, yes, you're the people who don't have the charisma to become accountants. So I'm hoping that nevertheless this might be of some use to you. Just a wee bit about the situation of Gaelic in Scotland in terms of percentage. If you look at the bottom line, Scotland, and we look at the number of population with some knowledge of Gaelic, so they can get by, not necessarily fluent. And incidentally, I can give everyone a copy of my PowerPoint if you want. I've got a much bigger one, I cut it down for this. But 1.7% there. If you look at the top, you've got the Western Isles has 61%, you know, have some knowledge of Gaelic. Skyloch Alsh, 34.3. Urban areas are interesting. Glasgow, you've got 9,500 people there with some knowledge. So it's 1.7%, roughly the same as Scotland as a whole, a wee bit less in Edinburgh at 1.3. But it's interesting that we'll have more and more Gaels living in the Central Belt. There's about half of the Gaels there these days, but it's a much smaller percentage. So this will be of interest to you, I think, in Belfast as well, compared to other areas where there are Irish speakers. Now, I just want to talk about attitudes to Gaelic. When I started working in this area, one of the things I was worried about was the amount of bad publicity that you tended to see, or I felt you tended to see in newspapers about Gaelic. And it was the usual question about the potholes. You know, I think we could solve the problem of potholes if you only stopped spending money on Gaelic and so on. So I did a big study for Born in the Gaelic, thinking it's going to be overwhelmingly negative. But it turned out I was just remembering the negative bits. When you actually look at the figures, it was quite a large study, 42 publications, studied over 15 months. What I found was that the positive view of Gaelic as a whole, and I'm going to link this back to the establishment of the Gaelic Language Act and the Gaelic Language Board and the effect that has had, that it's become much more positive, where you find positive attitudes outweigh negative ones 4-1, basically. And when you look at the themes, and I had no idea what we'd find, the things that the public found positive about Gaelic were education, they saw that as a benefit. Gaelic culture in general. Gaelic as a resource for understanding parts of Scotland. Specific individuals tended to get a good coverage, but also things like art, music, poetry, and Gaelic in the media, and so on. Now, this reflects in some ways some wider attitudes. The Scottish Centre for Social Research just 4 years ago undertook a large-scale survey, and it found that 76% of the Scottish population saw the Gaelic language as an important part of Scotland's heritage. Now, interestingly, 70% of this cohort hadn't had any exposure to Gaelic. So they were actually coming to it from a pretty neutral point of view, you might say. You'll see also 85% believe that Gaelic speakers should have the right to use Gaelic, with a local council. 48% believe they should have a right to educate their kids in Gaelic, and we don't have that right in Scotland because it's, you know, the resources are pretty sparse still. 81% wished that there should be at least as many Gaelic speakers in Scotland in 50 years, but only half of those thought this would be the case. So a wee bit of pessimism, but the what I'm trying to say is the mood music towards Scottish Gaelic is positive compared to what I can remember when I was growing up. And I think this is very good. Now, looking at, the other one, just I thought that was interesting, bilingual road signage, because like potholes, this is one that comes up. All the accidents that apparently can be called caused by bilingual road signage. But you find that almost half Scottish people that took part in it are in favour of this as well. So the current policy position is different from Wales. In 2003, the Gaelic Language Board, Bosch na Gaelic, was established and asked to prepare national Gaelic a national language plan for Scotland every 5 years, and also to require any public body to prepare one. So every year, I think it's 10 public bodies are asked to prepare a language plan, such as the councils. And as Murray was saying, at the moment, I'm doing my second lot of investigation, secret shopping, phoning up, looking at the website and so on, of 10 organisations. I did the first tranche quite a few years ago as well to see, you know, how the plans live up to the actual output and so on. Now, the position of Gaelic is a strange one, a very weak one. We have official status to the language, and it says it should command equal respect. Now, the problem is, of course, that equal respect is not a term that, well, lawyers could make an awful lot of money out of it. It's something that doesn't have a defined meaning, really, in law. Just a wee bit about the plan. The outcomes that the Gaelic Language Board want to have an impact on are those ones there: home and early years, education, post-school education, communities, and so on. Own heritage, tourism, and the Gaelic language itself. Now, compared with elsewhere, I was very, very impressed. It was great to hear about Wales, but Scottish legislation is weaker than most other well-known legislation, legislative areas. Catalonia is one of them, Canada, Wales. It's not legally enforceable as well. We wish we had a commissioner and so on. As I say, equal respect has no clearly defined meaning in law. Having said that, however, the majority, almost, I think all now of the council regions have published a plan or indeed are in the middle of doing that. And some universities have, other organisations as well are doing that. Some of them are quite useful. Now, what's the problem facing Scotland? Well, if I look at it from a bit of an economics point of view, if you can allow me to do that, here's something from the Highlands and Islands Development Board in 1989. It's now called the Highlands and Islands Enterprise. They were looking at, they saw a link between difficulties in stimulating the economy and the community through the economy. They saw a link between that and language use, okay? And you'll see the bits I've put in blue, that they've said that where there's a low status of the language and culture, it has a debilitating effect on self-confidence. And it's no coincidence that the Gaelic-speaking areas are amongst the most difficult in which to stimulate economic development. So that's only 1989, it's not that long ago. I'm going to argue that figures show this is actually on the way to changing. In 2001, the McPherson report for the Scottish Government, Gaelic is a critically ill patient on life support. The prognosis is bleak. Well, they like to tell it as it is, you know. But I don't think we would say that. I don't think that's what the Scottish Government would say now. So my question is, when I think what you have is the position of Scottish Gaelic is beginning to turn in public perception and in that of policymakers from an enemy insofar as, oh, It's a dying language. You'll never go far in it. Has nothing to offer at the modern world. You certainly can't use it in the economy, to one where it can be an ally and where you can use diversity and sort of dynamism you can get, particularly through art and culture, you know, in actually helping boost not only rural areas, which is what is in most people's minds, I think, when they think of Scottish Gaelic, but also, for instance, in the media sector in Glasgow, where I've done a study of it. Now, you'll have heard possibly you've heard the phrase, no jobs means no people, no people, no Gaeltacht. The problem was that if you just reversed that and said, right, get more people, you might get English-speaking workers moving into Gaelic-speaking areas. So you got people, but you still didn't have the language and, you know, the community. So there was always a difficult balance to get in that. And I think the work from the 1960s has shown that it is possible to move in the right direction and to get things working together rather than working against each other. And this might be an argument that is of interest to yourself here in the North. In Scotland, for instance, only in the 60s did you first see a positive view of Gaelic in education. Right up to the 70s, you got, I think the 70s was the last time I saw a really damning report by the Her Majesty's Inspectorate saying that not only is Gaelic not helpful in schools, but it needs to be discouraged. Now, you wouldn't get that now, but the change began in the 60s and so on, about education, but also art and culture, that might be useful in lots of ways. So that HIDB, the Highlands and Islands Development Board, which was pushed in, incidentally, by the trade union movement. So, you know, it's not just something from the top, it's something from popular movements as well. What you had was a recognition that different things could complement each other. And this was followed by various reports, The Heart of Gaelic by Tony Mackay, and then various others. And I began to get involved in the late 90s in this. So these are just some of the reports. These are all available, and if anyone needs details, I can give you them as well. What you also got, as well as reports, was the development of an infrastructure mostly in terms of the arts, but then it moved a bit wider. So you had the Gaelic Arts Agency, Project Nainyellyn, Ceolas in South Uist, there's a big music festival, which provides a lot of work, but it's for a week or a couple of weeks every summer. Fashion and Gael, and the Gaelic TV Committee in 1981. Again, now it's interesting, you're talking about the Tories, Mary, about where the money come from. The Tories gave £9.1 million, the biggest amount that had ever been given for media towards trying to create more Gaelic television programmes. And this eventually went on to be BBC Alba. And interestingly, Gaelic, Scottish Gaelic, has never really had a political orientation, nor has it had a religious one. The Tories have tended to give it a lot of money. When the Gaelic Language Board came in 2003, that was done by a coalition of Labour and Liberal Democrats in the Scottish Parliament. And these days it's the SNP now, and it's a minority government, of course. Occasionally you'll get Labour members who don't know their history trying to kick lumps out of the SNP and say, oh, Gaelic, you know, all the other nationalist things, not knowing that the history is the Tories gave it the most money at the start, and it was Labour and the Liberal Democrats brought it in. And in terms of religion, if you look at the Western Isles, Gaelic was used as a battle between the Protestant churches and the Catholic churches, both of which adopted it, you know, to try and win over their particular religious battle. So you have in the Long Island, Lewis Harris, you'll get in the Wee Freeze, and so on. Well, you know, you get sermons in Gaelic, there's a bigger element in Gaelic there than you would get on the mainland. Similarly, you go south to Barra of Attersea, Catholic Church is as prominent. So we're very fortunate in terms of we don't have to overcome things. And similarly, I think, looking at Wales from outside, you know, the language links to the politics of the parties. again, in Scotland, we're fortunate. It doesn't seem to be the case. Anyway, what you did have, money came in, but reports like those of the Scottish Government said you really need to coordinate things a wee bit more. And this is what led to the Gaelic Language Act and the Board in the Gaelic, because resources were just going in depending on ministers having a particular interest or not, and so on, which meant things weren't coordinated. So, again, you got further reports saying, here's how we can do this a wee bit more contextually clever, and so on, and you began to get looking at whether language and economic development could complement each other. And you began to measure the Gaelic labour market. How many people actually have jobs in this area? What is the field, you know, where are the shortages? All this sort of stuff. More on the demand for Gaelic arts and so on. Some of the figures are of interest, perhaps. 1993, the first big study looking at Gaelic-related economic activities, it was thought, and it's quite robust, £41 million at that time, creating almost 1,000 full-time FTEs. This was over media and part of education in this. Later on, education sort of comes out of it, mostly. But if you look at just art and culture, the work, for instance, I did, again, £4 million, looking at between up to about 230 workers there. We looked at the Gaelic labour market overall, trying to be a bit more specific where we could find evidence. And then in an urban area in Glasgow, I did some work with a colleague on Celtic Connections, you know, the big music festival, and on the Gaelic media. And we found that in the BBC Alba and so on, there was £2.5 million spent with about 140 really highly technological jobs linked to this. And interestingly, Celtic Connections, although, remember, there's only 1.7% Scots have some sort of Gaelic, similarly in Glasgow, you found that 12% of the attendances were to Gaelic-related music or culture. So that began to get people interested. Some other studies that were done over the long term, 1998 and 2008, looked at what was the impact of a vibrant Gaelic arts environment and so on. And what you find is that it was interesting that as soon as some... what you had was divisions in people's opinions. You had a very small group of people who thought Gaelic had no relevance to the modern world whatsoever. And then as soon as people actually became involved in attending anything that involved Gaelic art and culture, it all became an awful lot more positive. You know, so you had very concentrated negative, but very small. And then the more that people became involved, it became much more positive. And this lasted over the 10 years. It was a big survey over 10 years, two surveys over 10 years. And it was remarkably consistent. You know, things like the development of the Gaelic language art and culture is increasing the desire of young people to live and work in their home area. It's increasing the attractiveness of the area to tourists. It makes an important contribution to self-confidence and so on. So these are good, quite hard data in some ways, although I've called them soft impacts there. I did then go and try and see if you could quantify things like that. Now, the Gaelic media, just a couple of words on that, in terms of making things positive, BBC Alba is watched by about 600,000 people per week, which is massively more than the 80-odd thousand people that have an understanding of Gaelic. Now, some of the factors are that there's a good element of sport and music on it, but also one thing that's different from Wales, and we could maybe talk about this offline, is almost all the stuff on BBC Alba is subtitled, so it's open to people. When I bounce through and cut my S4C, I find it, well, I'm locked out of it. You know, so I'm wondering if there's something there that can be looked at. Although, amongst the Gaelic community, there's no ability to switch off the subtitles, which is really, really annoying as well. But TV is very, very interesting in this area. Right, Gaelic arts, there was a big publication on the role of the Gaelic arts, and again, the head of the HIE, Highlands and Islands Enterprise, they thought the evidence showed a direct link between levels of confidence, and this was linked to whether you had a vibrant cultural and artistic life in the areas looked at, a direct link between that and levels of economic activity and economic growth. So they argued, and they were the first people to say, we actually want Gaelic art and culture to be seen as a developmental benefit to the general economic and social development of difficult areas. This was mostly rural here. So the most recent research, what else have we had? Oh yeah, this is one I've just finished doing. We were given a task at my university and with others, including one of the Welsh universities, trying to look at evidencing the current and potential use of Gaelic as an asset to the economy and society of the Highlands and Islands and Scotland as a whole. Now, you know, as a Gaelic, someone interested in the language as the language, I can see it's a problem. You don't want to just quantify things as an asset, but if you do have the figures, it can really help sometimes. So we looked at this. Loads of interviews, focus groups, surveys, hundreds of businesses. The study wasn't comprehensive, but we've worked out where the gaps are and so on. And we worked with a whole load of quangos as well as with HIE. There's the sort of thing we did, individual case studies of things like the Hebkelt Festival in Stornoway, some of the hotels using Gaelic, you know, ones where we could try and see if, essentially the job was to say, if you use Gaelic, can we work out in a robust manner that isn't just imagining good news, in a robust manner, how much of your turnover can be attributed to Gaelic. See if you can do that. And then we looked at other areas that were similar where they didn't feel they could do the same, and we made some quite sensible assumptions. Okay, if we do that for them, what figures can we come up with? And so on. We also did the Gaelic media sector, Gaelic and Scotch whisky tourism. We've got lots of reports. If anybody wants copies, again, see me at the end and I can get them to you. So what we found was that for the businesses that did use Gaelic and that we looked at, we found that those that thought it as a major boost, something that was really important for them, they thought it for three reasons: distinctiveness, uniqueness, authenticity and provenance, and it also increased the appeal to the markets they were going for. For the ones that said, well, it has a major or a moderate one, they thought that, but they also said, it increases your profile, helps to attract new customers, and so on. So we've got lots of data, and it's all downloadable for you to see. In terms of the social value, it was good news, and it tended to back up the longitudinal studies that had begun to be done in the area. We put questions in that would allow this to be compared. So things like increasing in Gaelic-related job opportunities and attachment of people to their communities, increasing pride, increasing self-confidence, the sort of thing that can build up a dynamic, entrepreneurial area. Now, the other things that we found, the themes that came out were that Gaelic needs to be looked as a positive thing. And I think we've won round most of the policy makers who at one end were thinking, oh, Gaelic, you know, that's something you tick, but it can't provide, to seeing, actually, here's evidence that it can provide. So the importance of positively treating it as an asset. The importance of normalisation, and I think this is the biggest thing that the Board of Gaelic, plus BBC ALBA, and so on, have done in the last 10 or so years. And I think this is what has knocked on public opinion, and indeed, the realisation by businesses they can use this positively and so on. So these are some of the things I took from. Now, economic value. we managed to get 34 quite big enterprises who believed they could robustly identify what percentage was it. They might say 75% of what we do is directly related to Gaelic. If we didn't do this in Gaelic, we would not have that, you know. And we were quite hard with them on that because we didn't want any fanciful figures and we didn't know what was going to come out. So they found 4 million. Then what we did was we, you know, you might get something like two art centres, both of which did the same thing. One of which said, yeah, we keep our figures this way. Here's how we'll work out the Gaelic impact. The other one said, well, we do similar things, but we don't keep the figures like that. So we did a matching process and made some assumptions, but it allowed us to get up to over 50 firms. And we found that you could actually attribute maybe 5.6 million to that. So what about the Scottish economy? What about elsewhere where Gaelic wasn't being used? Well, we're getting pressurised from Highlands and Isles and Enterprise, who wanted a, you know, everybody wants a big figure because it justifies what they do. But we said, no, this has got to be something that, if anything, is conservative. Anyway, what we did was we estimated, we looked at Gaelic speakers and so on and the context that firms were working in. We narrowed down to media, tourism, food and so on, where we thought we could really justify what we're doing. So creative industries, tourism, food and drink. We used the research that we think we could definitely give an accurate figure as something to apply wider. We looked at the census data on language skills in the area and so on to say, well, if you have the same measurement of language skills, we know what it did elsewhere. Here's what possibly it could do. Anyway, the figures we came to were, depending on the assumptions you made, they were very, very impressive, I think. And we would argue that this stands up, that the potential value of Gaelic as an asset to the Scottish economy could be in the region of between 82 million and 150, depending on how strict your assumptions were. And in our study, we lay them out so people can agree with them or not, but there's nothing hidden in it. So, almost finished now. Opportunities. Well, we thought the main areas there was potential to enhance and develop the role of Gaelic was tourism, the Gaelic speaking learning market as well, plus where Gaelic enhanced distinctiveness, differentiated things and so on, could appeal to tourists. Creative industries, looking at artistic drama, literature, music and so on. And then education and learning. We argue quite firmly that this is what you can do there as well. So these are the opportunities. The barriers, there are lots of barriers and some of them are skills, as was mentioned. The barriers and challenges were general capacity and resources, then the existing lack of Gaelic knowledge and expertise. So we have people who are Gaelic speakers, but they've never had sat and examined it, so they don't believe they can be on a reception in case their Gaelic isn't up to Sol Morostig, you know, the Gaelic college standard or anything like that. So there's cultural issues as well, and lack of giving people the credit that they actually have achieved through being Gaelic speakers and so on. So there are barriers to this. The benefits, though, are the profile and awareness to business, direct economic impacts, which were mentioned, mutual benefits to business and community. And I haven't mentioned any of the social impacts. I've narrowed what I've told you there to the economic ones. Normalisation of Gaelic and support for Gaelic. So, when you look at, I'll finish my last one, 2001 situation, Gaelic is a critically ill patient on life support, the prognosis is bleak. Well, what's this year? It's responding well, but it's now not out of intensive care. So there we are. That, I hope that's of some use to you. Thank you.
I think
that was useful to get. It was a different insight than the talks up until now, because we were looking at it from an economic point of view, and I think that'll help, you know, help us create the argument for Act na Gaeilge in the north here. If we can look at it in that way and, you know, put figures behind what we're saying, it sort of helps alleviate some of the bad press that's going away. Any questions? Make yourself the back side.
Right, very brief. That's really another total discussion. But let me see, what can I say about them? They're, I think the majority of ones that I've examined are ones where organisations sincerely are trying to do something. They're not ticking the boxes. We do get that as well, but the majority are where people have come up with plans with a process and some proposals agreed by the Gaelic Language Board, and they then self-report every year to the Gaelic Language Board, and then after 3 or 4 years the Gaelic Language Board asks independent researchers to look at it, and as I mentioned, I looked at the first 10 and I'm currently finishing off the most current ones. We've had some really, really good results. We've had some dreadful results where people, you know, that we can't get interviews, you know, or when we do get interviews, we say that we're told everything's fine, here's what we're doing, we read the plans, and then we do a secret shopping, we phone up and nobody knows how to speak Gaelic, and neither do they know who would, you know, so they don't even signpost stuff. So I wish they had more power. They're a very useful thing to have, because in most cases they're quite realistic. When we are doing independent reports, we say, well, this is not bad, but the low level of Gaelic fluency means it's always going to be a top-down thing. And what you really need to tackle, and we put recommendations at the end to the organisation and to the Gaelic Language Board, so what you need to tackle is, what is your active offer to staff? How can you get the staff fluency up so that they see language as something that affects them and something that they're part of, rather than what their boss tells them, you must do this? You know, something that they can see is important. I hope that helps, but there are reports, you know, the investigations are available, you know, the results of them.
Yeah. Yeah, this is more of an observation than a question. Gary alluded to it at the end, and the idea of case studies. It's interesting that, you know, there's no intrinsic right to get Gaelic medium education within the Scottish Language Act. If you take, for example, there are two areas within the north, one in Carntaher and one round in Droihead, and basically they are enterprises, social enterprises, that have grown up and have grown around Irish medium education, where you have an Irish medium school, and I would think that if the Gaelic Act was focused on the right to Gaelic medium education, you would actually see a huge growth in the economic benefits of the language as well, because again we have seen everything that's associated with the language, you know, the support mechanisms that are required, and I think that an emphasis in any act, from a personal point of view, that the right to Gaelic, whether it's Gaelic medium, Welsh medium education, etc., that is the central key. It is the bilingual, the education movement drives this, and I would suggest that the figures would be considerably higher in this case of Scotland.
Yeah, there are real problems getting enough teachers. It's a really difficult problem. The Scottish Government, I think, would love to have more. Where there have been there has been investment in education, like Solma Rostig, which higher education, of course, in Skye, that's had a bit of a boost. It's like an artificial island in some ways, it's causing. In Glasgow, for the first time, I think 4 years ago, Glasgow was the only place where you had total immersion. You know, you didn't have that in the Western Isles. People in the Western Isles would say, oh, well, you know, we speak the language, it's not endangered. And it really is endangered there. But in Glasgow, where it was clearly, there was a battle to be done, you now have immersion from primary right up to sixth year in school, and they've just opened a second school. In fact, what you find is the school's done so well that there's, I think, the majority of pupils that go there, they're not from a Gaelic-speaking background. You know, so you get the critics in the, well, the Daily Mail hate it, of course, Daily Express, but you also get critics from, not, say, the workerist trained or whatever, but saying, oh, it's just a middle-class thing. It's not anything to do with the Gaelic language. It's to get a sort of a comprehensive school, but one that has standards and so on. So there are battles like that to go on, but it's a success story. But I take your point, as you said.
Time for one more question, if anyone.
Do you like
the Gaelic
language? Sorry? The Gaelic language is probably a
it's probably good. Daily Express were found in the Daily Mail wasn't as bad as the Daily Express. They were the ones that were the worst, I found.
Anyway. We just thank both speakers again.
Thanks.
And say